Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Interfaith Leadership Council podcast series. My name is Saeed Khan, your host and moderator for this particular session, looking at anti-diversity and anti-democracy, and mapping it out as to how this is going to play a role and how interfaith communities can play a role in trying to tackle these very timely and very important issues. A little bit of background on myself. I am a senior lecturer in Near East and Asian Studies, as well as Director of Global Studies at Wayne State University. And we are joined by three wonderful panelists, one who is a member of the Wayne State family, and two who are dear friends going back more years than we should need to count, and certainly to protect their identity, I won't. So let's go ahead and get started. So we have Shirley Stancata, who is a newly seated member of the Wayne State Board of Governors, also president and CEO of New Detroit Leadership Coalition. Welcome, Shirley.
Thank you. I retired from New Detroit, but I am on the Board of Governors of Wayne State. Thank you.
Okay. Stand corrected on that one. Thank you. We have Steve Spreitzer from the Michigan Roundtable of Diversity and Inclusion. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you.
Okay. And we have Rabbi Sam Englander, whose latest position is as the Michigan Regional Outreach Manager for the One America Movement. Welcome, Sam.
Thanks so much. Pleasure to be here.
So this issue, certainly, of diversity and the challenges to try to maintain it have touched on other elements, including whether here in the United States we even have to broach the subject about how democratic our society still is. And in recent times, and the imagery that we have seen, whether it was on January the 6th at the U.S. Capitol, whether it is certain initiatives that are being taken in state legislatures, which ostensibly are curbing access to the voting and the democratic process when it comes to issues of cancel culture, as well as the challenges facing communities in what can be said, where it can be said, and how it can be said. We're living in a particular moment of our nation's history and our nation's cultural trajectory that is important to sort out and to then try to understand where do we go together moving forward. So I'd like to actually start with a question, perhaps to you, Shirley. When you think about the word diversity, and especially within both a university community as well as in the broader Metro Detroit community, what does that word mean to you when you hear it for the on first impression, and how do you see it playing out in both of those scenarios?
Well, in terms of diversity, I think about it, it's like boiling the ocean. You know, there's all kinds of perspectives. I talk about the fact I'm left-handed, right? And that's a diversity issue really for me. Now, for the most part, people think about it as relates to age and race and, you know, social economics and gender identity and all those kinds of things. So it is as broad as it can be, right? And I think that in and of itself, has some issues, and we can talk about that later because it has to be what my perspective is versus what someone else's perspective is. What was the second part of your question, Saeed?
Well, the second question is that how do you see this playing out at a place like a university community or Metro Detroit? I mean, here you have these really vibrant ecosystems, and yet diversity, as you said, is, and that's a great phrase, boiling the ocean. Mm-hmm. You see it certainly bubble up in different ways in each of these capacities?
Well, the university, Wayne State University, it really is a reflection of the broader community, not just Detroit, but the state as a whole is a state or statewide university. And really in so many ways, the world, we have folks who are first generation college students, a first generation in this country. Some have been gone for a long time, all races, et cetera, backgrounds, genders. And so that's a reflection. And so what we have to think about, those of us in the university, living that university life, is then we have to behave as if this really were a country. What's going on outside really in a lot of ways has to reflect what's going on inside and vice versa. We have to have a staff that understands it, professors, you know, from the bottom all the way up, that understands what diversity is as a first step. And I think that's a first step, because oftentimes, Saeed, people get working on it before we've had a discussion and some kind of agreement as to what it is and what it means to us, or whomever the us is.
So, Steve, we've been working in the field of interfaith diversity and inclusion for some time. We've known each other for quite a while. And sometimes it feels as though these discussions, as Shirley mentioned, don't necessarily get fully completed. Sometimes new issues come up. And sometimes it feels as though the ground underneath us is moving. And so it's always trying to maintain our balance and yet still have this forward-looking progress. How has diversity impacted your work, and particularly that when it comes to the interfaith spaces?
Well, thanks, Saeed. It's good to be with two of my teachers and new friends. Look, the impact will be perpetually felt as long as we view these matters as an issue of charity versus a social justice issue. St. John Chrysostom, it's a hard name to say, but he did an explication on the seventh commandment and talked about, you know, that sense that anything we have that we don't need has been stolen. It's property of the other. If it's extra food we don't use, it's the property of the poor. In the case of the epiphany we all had with George Floyd's brutal murder, we start to see how people have responded, treating deep-seated racism as though it was something that could be handled with charity. And the result of that is patronizing, tokenizing, using philanthropy to do nothing to help one's self-determination or these deep issues. So I think this has opened a window for the faith community to examine the supremacy within themselves. And in the case of the United States, we would look at the Christian supremacy, which when married to white supremacy, with white supremacy, was deadly for our indigenous peoples, right? And then we look at other forms of internalized supremacy and how that plays out. So it is a window for the faith community to take a look at itself, the shadow side that is not inherent in the formula, but in how the faith tradition is used by people for political or economic gain. And those of you who have international ties can see how that plays out. I'll stop there. I'm just doing my jumping jacks right now.
All right, I'll let you get warmed up then, Steve. Thanks. So, Sam, you and I represent different religious communities, which, as far as size-wise, certainly are relatively small within the broader American mosaic. And arguably, then it means that diversity occurs as soon as we step out the front door of our homes. How have you found then, particularly with the Jewish American community, navigating what seems to be this constant ebb and flow of where diversity fits in, at the same time trying to, where it can be achieved, reach a kind of a standardization of purpose?
And when you say standardization of purpose, what do you mean? Can you tell me more?
Well, sure. I mean, how do we bring our diversity to the majority and find a common cause?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a broader look. I can speak locally to the Jewish community, which I think, you know, most Jews in America, 90% are Ashkenazi, which means descended from Jews living in Europe, right? So we have lighter skin than the traditional person of color, so to speak. So I think for us, it really is a question of what is a minority. We view ourselves in certain situations definitely as a minority, but how do we benefit from white privilege and all of those types of questions? So that's something that definitely the Jewish community is in conversation with and dealing with. And I think for me personally, you know, a lot of it depends on context. In Metro Detroit, I very much, you know, have never experienced really any sort of discrimination. And then when I've been in spaces that are actually at Michigan State, where I just met folks who had never met a Jew before, and in New York City, where there is the opposite situation, where there is an incredible amount of diversity, but there's a significant more animosity because of complicated reasons. I felt more personally in the minority, but I think for me, it's the larger question of diversity is one that I think that we need to think of in terms of understanding kind of the similarities. And I think a lot of focus is on the unique perspectives that we each bring, and that is true, but I think more needs to be done. Work needs to be done focusing on the fact of kind of how what we share in common simply by dint of being human.
When you said that you were at Michigan State and there were people there who had never met a Jew before, and then you said the opposite is true in New York, I thought when you got there, people hadn't actually met a Spartan before. but I don't know if that's true, because I know my friend Steve has been to New York City, and I know he wears his Spartan merch quite proudly. so there you go. Shirley, how bad is the challenge to diversity then right now? I mean, I know that you, and I'm very glad you did, you placed it into this broader construct of things that we don't necessarily think of. And I agree with you. I'm right-handed. I'm almost militantly right-handed in the sense that I really can't do that much with my left hand. And I find myself in class to sometimes have to ask when I see a student struggling who's left-handed in the many desks that don't accommodate them, to ask a student, do you mind switching if you're writing with a right hand on a left-handed a desk. How much of a challenge do you see diversity currently, especially when it comes to the kind of rhetoric from various channels in our culture today?
You know, I think it all goes back to what I talked about earlier, this whole idea of having the conversation and having some agreement about what it means. You know, the reason we're having this conversation about the concern about our democracy is that, you know, this democracy is built on supposedly a common understanding of what we mean by that, right? And we don't have the time to talk about sort of what does that mean. Democracy, our country, in and of itself, is an experiment. I just got finished reading Barack Obama's book. It's called A Promised Land. And that promise, you have to read it to go, oh, wait a minute. It's not what it is now. It's what we're working to make it, right? It's a promise. This is what's going to happen. And so our job is to work to make that happen. And so I think that there will constantly be issues around diversity because we don't agree with what it is, but we need to stop and have the conversation and understand that this journey, this is a lifelong journey where we have to explain to people how it's my responsibility to stop and explain, et cetera. Let me tell you what I mean by this. What do you mean by that? We get some kind of understanding and moving forward. We're never going to all agree, really, on what diversity means. But what we all should do is look at the principles upon which this country was built. You know, you got the Declaration of Independence, which said, hey, we got a new country coming here, 1776. Then we have the Constitution and, you know, the Bill of Rights or all these things that are... People don't know that those kinds of things exist. They're not studying it in school. I get on my soapbox here for a while. They don't, but that helps us have this common understanding. So we have a lot of work to do in organizations that we're talking about around helping people to understand what is meant and what our country really is based on. And diversity clearly is one of the big pieces of that, you know, inalienable rights, right? By the people, where it's governed by the people, all of us. And so what does all of us mean? And I think that we make some assumptions and we all get comfortable and we keep moving forward. And then when we have this spot, I mean, it happens, it's happened throughout the history of this country, then we stop. I'm glad, Saeed, that we've stopped to have these kinds of conversations, because that's so important about helping us get to where we build this promise of this country.
I like, if anyone's seen it, former President Obama sitting down with Bruce Springsteen in his podcast. Yeah. And of course, Springsteen had the wonderful song, Promised Land.
Yeah.
I mean, it's such an evocative tune. Steve, Shirley mentioned the word democracy. And when we think about democracy, we think not only of it being the power of the people, by the people, and for the people. But of course, implicit within that is the fact that the majority will prevail with their views. And at least, of course, in the American experiment, as Shirley said, there are safeguards to prevent majority rule to the exclusion, not just the expense of the minority. How do you see currently in this winner take all by 50.1% within the democratic system? Is that really what we mean by democracy? Is that in fact democracy in name only and perhaps anti-democratic? And how do you see that affecting the conversation of diversity?
Good question. I'm reminded of the words of Hubert Humphrey, who spoke about what democracy is, about how it is when we take care of those people that have been marginalized or harmed or aren't seen as having value or utility. As we all try to figure out what happened at the Capitol and this threat to democracy, right? It is this concept of the majority. I mean, really, it is the majority. And in this case, if 15% of the people are bigoted, prejudiced, and problematic, that's 15%. And 20% are woke and well, do well and really care about the other. And then there's this middle mass that can kind of go either way and allow for a perversion of democracy, allow for people like Dylann Roof, who murdered the 9 people at Mother Emanuel AME in Charleston. You know, they weren't white, and they, even though they were Christian, they were problematic for him. But where were the checks during his development? You know, I think when it works well, we know each other, we care about each other, and we're making sure that no one is marginalized, much less oppressed. But the problem is systems were created to favor white folk, and they were meant to favor Christians in this country. And so if you fall outside of that, you become at risk. And so I think our faith communities really need to just continue to go deeper and challenge each other because we can get this, right? It's a good formula here in our country. And this democracy and not having third world poverty does allow for all of our traditions to flourish. And people can't generalize, say, about Muslims because of what's happened in real poor areas of Pakistan. They can see the beauty of this great world religion, of all great world religions. I know I'd strayed a bit from your question, but I've been thinking about these matters as well. And, you know, we all get our death threats. Maybe you haven't gotten one recently, but those of us who stand on the side of the oppressed are a problem to the oppressor. So these are challenging times.
So a death threat is probably and arguably the most anti-diverse and anti-democratic expression that one can have. But of course, it's not the only one. Sam, Judaism and Islam, of course, are world religions. They've been around for a while. And certainly the Jewish diaspora, so to speak, and the Muslim Ummah have so much in common when it comes to the idea of broader communities, ones that are not just located in the United States. That brings a certain level of diversity. It brings, of course, a lot of complexity to these issues. And I'd like for you to pick up on what Steve is talking about here, is that how do we then acknowledge this kind of diversity on a global scale and still be centered to local issues? How do we bring communities together when it comes to a domestic lens by which to look through that? And I know you and I've worked on this to bring communities even here in the Metro Detroit area together and seen how that can always be, how can I put that? I'd say the word entertaining, but I don't want to make it sound like a movie, but certainly like a long mini-series like Ertugrul.
Yeah, great. You know, and I'll zoom out a little bit. I think a lot of the barriers, and that's what I hear you asking about, are the barriers to kind of doing this work is people are scared. There's a lot of fear. Mm-hmm. And that comes from all sides. You know, I recently spoke to a friend of mine who I'll be open. I'm you know, I consider myself a rather moderate Democrat. And, you know, he was a big, big Trump guy. And so I purposely reached out to him and we had a conversation. And it turns out at the end of that conversation, we agreed 90% on policy. I was shocked. I was floored. And we just had completely different views of kind of that 10% and how important that 10% was. And for me, you know, I was scared to have that conversation because I didn't know where it would lead. And now actually, you know, one of the things that I'm doing now through One America Movement, one of the things we're doing are trainings on how to talk to your neighbor. Like, that should be basic. We shouldn't have to have those trainings. That should be something that everyone knows how to do, but people either, they're scared to have those conversations because they don't know where they'll lead, or they have those conversations and they blow up in their face because they don't know how to have them in the right way. So, you know, for me, the huge barrier is it sounds simple. I think it can be trickier than it actually sounds, but it's simply getting past that fear and understanding that, you know, a lot of the assumptions we make about the other side, the meta perceptions that we have, aren't true. And kind of being open to speaking to people.
So what's causing that fear? Is it a fear of cancel culture, Sam? Is it a fear of a perceived disloyalty to one's own team? What are the driving forces that you see behind this?
Yeah, I mean, I think we are people of groups. We are people who, you know, think in terms of our own group identity. And because those groups are becoming hardened and hardened, especially politically, that when we imagine someone who we more and more often don't actually have, you know, friend, close friendship with, we assume that they don't like us. And I think that's really where it starts. To kind of the short version to answer your question is we assume they don't like us. It doesn't even start with we hating them or we disliking them. We assume, and there's a lot of, you know, there's organizations you can look up called Beyond Conflict. It's a great research organization that deals with exactly this question, which kind of talk about there's a huge gap. And when people say, well, how do you think that the opposing political party, whether they be Republicans or Democrats, how do you think they view you and how they actually view you? We're just wrong. We're incorrect. So I think that for whatever led us to kind of this political atmosphere, the zeitgeist, however it is, I think that's the cause is just we assume people don't like us. And that isn't necessarily the case.
Yeah. Steve, did you want to add to that?
No, I was just affirming.
Okay.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Please feel free to go ahead, and if you'd like to jump in on respond to one another, if you have a Shirley, would you like to?
I was going to just comment on something that sort of agree with what Sam said about when you asked the question, you know, sort of why is that about this disagreement? I will tell you that after years and years and years of having these, and Steve knows, conversations on race with folks who weren't alike. The reason that there are two reasons that people really don't have conversations with each other are fear and trust, right? They don't trust each other because they fear each other, and they fear each other because they don't know each other. They haven't taken the time to have those conversations. And it is really important when you begin to have these conversations, put some structure around them. And not, you know, not everybody talks at once, because in certain cultures, mine, everybody talks at once. But have about the whole idea of blame. People don't want to be blamed, right? I don't want you to call me racist, call me whatever. But instead of focus on individual blame, as Steve, let's focus on the systems, the structures, those kinds of pieces. So people are not going to have a conversation because they fear, oh, you might say something about me. But let's sit down and say, look, we're going to have this conversation and let's talk about, let's not blame each other. Let's focus on the systems. That the other thing that I really want to mention around that has to do with the whole idea of, and Sam talked about it also earlier, about where we are alike. And, you know, when you have these conversations, you get to figure that out, that in so many ways you are alike. So many of us, regardless of what circle we're in or what bubble we're in, right, we think about the things that we have that cause us pain as a person of color, as a woman, as a person, you know, all those kinds of things within this country. And we spend all of our time comparing that pain. So if I'm African-American, my pain is worse because my people were brought here, and Sam, you're Jewish, and we go through all of this stuff. Instead of taking the time to do what I always talk about, let's have this conversation. We both have headaches. You know, all of us have headaches, right? And so we agree, mine and they might, yours is on the scale or whatever. Why don't we spend some time saying, okay, Shirley, what do you do to help your headache? And I'll say, well, I take a leave, Billy, you know, And Sammy, what do you do to help your head? Make you run around the block, but talk about the things that help us. And when we begin to do that, we'll see that we'll be able to knock down some of these walls that are up. Have that conversation, have a no-fault environment. Let's not blame anything. And let's talk about the things that help us get to a better place. And I think that'll bring us really closer together.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, Sam, just getting back to you on that. There's a difference between a fundamental disagreement and a fundamental barrier. And it seems from the example that you cited with the gentleman who's a Trump supporter, you have the fundamental disagreement, but you don't let it turn into a fundamental barrier. The converse, of course, I suppose, can occur where there's a fundamental barrier, but you don't disagree on something. I remember giving a lecture and saying that I'm not going to work with somebody who wants to kill me. That would be a fundamental barrier, except there's no fundamental disagreement that he wants to kill me and I know he wants to kill me. So we've had to deal, and I see this, I'm speaking from the context of Muslim-Jewish relations, where there are certainly elements that consider certain issues to be fundamental barriers, that there is no possibility to proceed beyond that. And I'm wondering, what are some of the issues in a broader diversity context that you see that are that? I would imagine that there's far fewer of those fundamental barriers saying, that's it, can't proceed. There's a lot of open space, but what would you say are some of them that do exist?
Yeah, you know, it sounds like you're talking about red lines and kind of where we draw our red lines. And I think part of that stems from when we're talking and how we're thinking, we even have like different moral foundation, not different, but different combinations of moral foundations. You know, Jonathan Haidt, who's a researcher on moral psychology researcher, who's done a lot of work on this. He talks about that there's five different taste buds, moral taste buds that different folks have in different combinations. And so, you know, an example of that would be kind of focusing on equity, right? That's a moral taste bud, the equity model. Then there's other folks who focus on a loyalty model. And there's other folks who focus on a purity model. And no one is 100% each of these things. Usually we're some mix of them. And, you know, his argument is liberals are only kind of use two of these taste buds more, and conservatives have a kind of a larger mix of all of them. But where I'm leading to is that I think it's actually, even though I think it should be easier, and there are great benefits to doing kind of intra-congregational work. And I think there's a huge amount of need, especially with the political divides that are within the Christian community, that were in the Jewish community that I know, or even with in some places in the Muslim community in America, that there are these serious political divides, and kind of using our religious backgrounds and a religious faith and a religious traditions and texts to show, look, these are the ways you think and you speak, and our texts kind of speak to different aspects of those. And that we're just because you hold a kind of think about things differently doesn't mean that it isn't Jewish or it isn't Muslim. That being said, I do think, you know, that each of us have red lines and have to respect that. But, you know, I've already spoken enough.
Well, there's no such thing. We all benefit from anything that you have to say, Sam. So no need to provide a red line for your own communication. Steve, building on Sam's citing of Jonathan Haidt, the COVID pandemic has literally caused people to lose their sense of taste. And metaphorically, we're living at a time when it seems as though some people have similarly lost their moral taste buds in favor of a new metric, one that is hyper-nationalistic, one that is wrought with bigotry and a sense of supremacy and superiority. How is that impacting the work of organizations like the Michigan Roundtable?
Yeah. You know, I'm reminded of a verse from Christian scripture that says, you notice the speck in your sister's eye, but not the beam in your own eye. And, you know, the deeper we go in looking at you know, supremacy and misogyny and all of these things that are harming the other that we perpetrate come from one, I think, the fact that they dwell deep within us, right? Every one of us, as a consequence of now being a part of this American experiment, have deep in our DNA, racism, sexism, Christian superiority. It's in there. And to not understand it means you run around saying, I'm not racist, when it obviously that's such a low bar. Well, no, I am. I have racism in me and I'm working to be anti-racist. So to Shirley's point, conversations about that. One, giving people a safe place. I remember we were with a community group and two women of color were leading a large all-white audience. Could be any suburb, so don't try to guess. But anyway, some white folk in the room were talking about weaponized white privilege. And I said, I've heard a lot before, but I had never heard that. And one black woman in the room had to kind of, after we allowed that person to spew what was very toxic to me, people will moderate their view if they're respectfully heard. So allowing that person to say it and then getting a contrasting point of view and maybe moderating just a bit toward a more enlightened point of view, but not examining these things in a safe place won't get us to a brave place. And a brave place is being able to say, Steve, when you said that, that made me feel a certain way. The microaggressions I will perpetrate to my grave befuddle me, but yet humble me because it's so deep within me. I think having those conversations allows people to see stuff and challenge folks. I think of the cases where people went, whether it was Dylann Roof who killed in South Carolina or Omar Mateen who shot up the Pulse nightclub. And I think it was a case of his internalized homosexuality, his homophobia, being told that that's wrong rather than being loved for who he is, could have saved a lot of lives. Or Baruch Goldstein, in another way, this internalized supremacy, you could put anybody's name in there, but he killed some, 29 or so people in the Holy Land with his sense of things. Now, it is nothing wrong with the teaching of a tradition, but it's when one's own pathology and these other matters come and it plays out with killing some people at a nightclub or killing some people who have a different orientation toward politics. So I've read a bit, but I think it's an opportunity. It's a teaching moment, an opportunity for us to really look deeper and then move to the systems. An individual bigot or a relationally challenged person can harm a few people, but systems shorten lifespans, you know, and really mess with people. So that's hard. You know, I'll conclude this little piece here by quoting a great person named Dom Helder Camara, the Bishop of Recife, Brazil. The Catholic Archdiocese has a relationship with Brazil, or did. But he said, you know, when I fed the poor, you called me a saint. But when I asked why they were poor, you called me a communist. I don't know what we'd call them nowadays. But it's the pivot of dealing with diversity or its individual matters to moving toward the systemic view to equity, inclusion, and racial justice that I think is a hard move for people.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned Omar Mateen and the Pulse nightclub in Orlando and the shooting there. I just remember there was, of course, a very reflexive presumption in the media that this person acted essentially as an ISIS conduit because of being Muslim. And when a little bit more analysis was provided, it seemed, as you said, more inclined to having to do with some issues that he had suppressed homosexuality. What was astounding is that his father, when asked, would rather his son have been a terrorist than be a homosexual, was in complete denial about the possibility that his motivation had to do with sexual orientation and displaced anger. And getting to Sam's point about the moral taste buds and the prioritization, it shows how these challenges are. Assuredly, as Sam had said before, part of this fear is mistrust is based on people seemingly forgetting or never having learned how to have a conversation. Of course, we can put the blame on social media, which I'm not going to disagree with that too much on some things, but I wouldn't put all of the blame on that. But campuses are places of academic freedom. They are places of, as Oliver Wendell Holmes would have called it, the free marketplace of ideas. And yet at the same time, we're mindful though of these spaces as needing to be safe for students and for faculty and for anybody in the university community to have conversations, to be evocative, to perhaps even provoke inquiry, intellectual curiosity. How do you see this challenge playing out in the era of cancel culture, as well as certainly some toxic discourse that happens on campuses by students with one another, with faculty members towards students, and vice versa?
Well, a couple of things. I have to say one thing, though, before we move forward, is to my brother Steve, is that I think racism is taught. It's not in your DNA. I have to say that because you start talking DNA. I know what you meant, but when you start talking DNA, you say people are born that way. Let me just in terms of talking about campus, really, and the whole idea of freedom of expression of ideas. I think right now, I'm not saying it's social media or anything. I do think, though, that the media, I can talk about, I've had conversations over the past few weeks about George Floyd was one thing, but I remember being a little girl and in Alabama, they were putting their dogs on the people. And that is what helped to change, not immediately, but the Jim Crow laws in the South. And so it's important for us to continue to allow the exchange of ideas. But just getting back to what Sam taught, people don't know how to do this. We are also very surprised that there's all this negativism out, and people are saying this. People have been given really the approval to say whatever is on their mind, regardless. I had folks tell me, oh, I'm tired of being politically correct. And I'm like, what does that mean? You're tired of it. What does that mean? And so I want to be able to say what I say when I say it. All of this ugliness has been covered up. It didn't just grow. It's been allowed to come out. And I think those of us that have been doing this kind of work that we've been doing, we know we're making progress. We talk about hope, and that's important. We want to look at the progress. We have to remember that that other stuff is still there. It's just covered up. And so now it's come out. And I think we have to be courageous to say, okay, I understand you have a difference of opinion, but there's a certain way you have to talk to me about that, you know, that difference of opinion. Let's agree upon that. I told someone not too long ago, you don't have to be politically correct, but you can't use the N-word with me. That's my red line, right? And so everybody has it. But I think we need to give each other the freedom to talk, but let's say, here's how I need you to talk to me. The other thing is this, we also in so many ways have been socialized to say, if we disagree, that's wrong, right? The only way change can occur is through the creation of conflict. And conflict often is a difference of ideas. I often say, I never learned anything from somebody who agrees with me. It's through that disagreement and through that exchange of ideas that I've learned and I grow. And so we have to give each other the space. As long as I tell you what is okay with me, Sammy, what my red lines are, let's have those differences of opinion, because if we don't, we're never really going to move the needle in any way. So, and universities are exactly those kinds of places. Social media, great. That's what young people use now. All of us were young at some point, and Iman, you still are, but let's look at, here's what they're doing. And you too, Sammy, I didn't mean to leave you out. Here's what folks are doing now. Let's use it, but let's figure out how to do it, really. I want to be able to do all those kinds of things that express it. But let's understand how to talk to each other, but we got to talk. And we got to also know that in our work, the other stuff, like I said, is still there. It didn't go away.
Okay. Well, speaking on behalf of myself and Steve representing the senior circuit, thank you, Shirley. Every birthday that goes by,
Number is no longer a two or a three, then it.
like Indiana Jones says, you know, it's not the years, it's the mileage.
So, right.
So there right. You go. But I do want to focus, though, on the point that you make regarding the number in the beginning. When I was in my 20s, I really didn't have much patience for Joni Mitchell's music.
Oh.
I know, but it gets better. It gets better. I just found it to be a little bit too whiny and, you know, very, very non-goth, which is what I was in my 20s. And then in my 30s, I remember hearing Both Sides Now again. And I thought, okay, I don't dislike it. I won't turn it off when I hear it on the radio. maybe she's got a point. When I hit my 40s, I thought she was an oracle. Just wow. And fortunately, I found that in myself to change. Sam, we're dealing with people who are at different stages in their, shall we say, evolution, both from an
intro. I'm going to argue on that, but continue, please.
From on the Joni part or not? Well, okay, we'll get to that.
Yeah.
How do you then organize a community on an intra-faith level to the point where they can then be part of this broader diversity and inclusion narrative?
I think part of it is, you know, this is connecting to where, to kind of what Shirley said about how to communicate with people. And I think it's essential for people to do so by sharing their stories. And I think that's a lot less threatening to everyone when they share their stories and connected to an issue, connected to a political issue. But how has this affected me? Why is it that I view this way, that I have these views? And then I think people are able to be brought along. There's a reason I work, I'm a great fit for my organization, which is One America Movement, where we're not pushing any specific policy point, right? We're not an advocacy organization. We're not saying, look, you have to, you know, think exactly this about criminal justice. Really what we do is we bring people together. We teach people how to communicate through their experience on divisive issues, on real issues, mm-hmm. with the understanding that when people come out, they're going to be changed. And that not only that, but I think that the truth of what is the right response to any political issue, any real advocacy issue, comes from real human lives and real human concerns. So if you're not listening to those stories, then there's a problem and you won't reach the right answer. And I just want to give a brief shout out, so to speak, to we're launching a campus leadership incubator this coming academic year. So this is going to be in Michigan, specific to Michigan. This is going to be college students who, you know, want to come together from a diverse cohort, diverse racially, diverse ethnically, diverse politically, to come together to really, you know, be immersed in kind of this kind of work and then bring it back to their campuses. So if anyone knows anyone who's interested, take a look at oneamericamovement.org.
I'd love to talk to you about it because, as you know, Rabbi Asher Lopatin and I have been working with Ariane Menzel and David Polsky, Rabbi Polsky, on the Center for Civil Dialogue, having completed our first cohort on campus or coming up on it at Wayne State. Having those difficult conversations and then making it so that it's a safe space as well as fostering real friendship, because you realize that that is a cornerstone of having that kind of trust. One of my dearest friends, whom Sam and Steve, you both know, Muzammil Ahmed, whom I've known for a number of years. I remember once he said something just in it, sort of offhand and typical lovable Muzz fashion. He says, you know, we're friends and there's nothing that we can say to each other that will offend us. Meaning that we know it's coming from a place where there's not malice involved. And I think that that's really a goal. Steve, Sam mentioned the idea of having these kinds of conversations through storytelling. Now, I'll be the first to admit that storytelling, I suppose, as a craft, is a relatively new phenomenon. And I know that for some cultures, the stiff upper lip is oftentimes more pervasive. Growing up in England, I certainly found that. Of course, Meghan and Harry changed the dynamics of that 2 weeks ago. And I know that you and I have also taken the course through Harvard professor Marshall Ganz on developing a personal narrative. If you wouldn't mind sharing, how have you found that experience and how do you translate that into this kind of work to foster diversity, particularly when it comes to interfaith work?
Wow, yeah. For those of you who don't know Marshall Gantz, he remains over my head like the Hindenburg, leaving me more like Edith Bunker, pointing out to Archie that there's a Hindenburg ahead. You know, I think Marshall's focus on a strategic way of telling your story is important. You know, for me, I think, surely I'd simply want to agree with you earlier about we're socialized and taught to be racists, but the potential is in it. We're born with that. It's the unreconciled, unatoned actions toward our native people, toward people who were brought here in slavery. That stuff exists and can be combusted pretty easy, right? And I think certainly as a white person, I was born with a lot of unearned privilege, right? And so that's another story. But the story that I think for me is being vulnerable and being humble. And I think for people who are going to succeed in this work, to stop harm to the other, which is the work that the Roundtable and NCCJ began doing in 1927 at the peak of the Klan, that no one should be harmed because of their identity. I think there needs to, one, be a humility and a willingness to learn, because this journey, we're continually evolving. And speaking of stories, and I know I'm not going to the bullseye on your dartboard, but I have a dartboard too. So we had an experience, some of you remember in Kalkaska in 2017, when the first president called for death to all Muslims, to thin the herd of Black Lives Matter and to take out the gay people. He would have probably added the Jews, but that wasn't on his top list. But anyway, wanting to fly in there with my cape on, because I had spent 30 years or so lifting up my Muslim friends and they were, you're messing with my people. And I wanted to go in there and that white savior kind of deal, right? And I knew that I needed to be quiet and listen and be invited to allyship. And so the Michigan Muslim Community Council invited me to help organize the good people of Kalkaska. That's their town. And organizing was done by them. And I was more as a midwife, more just someone there. And I went in with the objectives to, one, stop the harm, to help organize and to let the people that were hateful to them know that there are people who cared, right? People cared about the Muslims and they needed to know that, Black folk and others. And, you know, there were two teachers that I'll never forget, Pardeep Singh Kalika and Arnold Michaelis. Pardeep Singh Kalika's father was one of the people, four people murdered at the Sikh Gurdwara in Oak Creek, Wisconsin, when a guy went in there, thought they were Muslims and terrorists and killed them. That was his dad, was one of those people. And he decided that his life was going to be dedicated to finding the people, the community where that shooter came from, and bringing love to them. Oh my God, that's the heart of Christianity, right? And here is a guy of another religion. Some of us Christian supremacist oriented would think that that's an inferior religion. But man, he moved my cheese more than anybody, I think. And then Arnold Michaelis, his partner, was from the community. He's all tattooed up. I remember meeting him. He glowed like an orange. But the two of them go around the country teaching people how to not be radicalized. And so what he said to me was, in all of the stuff in Kalkaska, that I had a goal I was missing. And that goal was to let that mayor know that he was loved. And I wasn't prayed up enough, right? He goes, did you call him? Oh, I sent him an email, call him. And I was like, I continue to come up against that, because I don't think I pray. I don't think I have the ecclesial aspect of my life, enough loving faith partners to help me get to the spiritual power to love the haters, right? And there's plenty of them in our life. And there are just plenty of people who may have harmed me that I'm not ready to go love them back. So sorry for preaching. I only made it through a couple weeks of the seminary and decided to get married. So, lucky my wife. I'm passing the baton back, and I'm sorry for stealing time from other speakers.
Not at all. Okay, so with the time we have remaining, I'm going to ask each of you the same question. America is going through a transition where in 20 years, we're going to become a majority minority country. I think a lot of what we see happening, playing out, the anxieties, are called moral panics, and they become flashpoints as they are expressed in a way that counters diversity, even counters democracy in order to preserve power or what is perceived as power. Shirley, what would be a hack that you would recommend for people to follow over the next 20 years? We've got the political, obviously, we've got the policy elements, but beyond that, what can people do?
I think that each of us, this whole idea, interfaith, the work around interfaith, around democracy, around interracial issues, really is a big puzzle. And I think that each of us has a puzzle piece in our hands. It's not in front of us on the table. It's in our hands, right? And so what we need to do then is take that puzzle piece, whatever it is, and put it in the appropriate place in the puzzle. Now, what that means is there's movement. And you've got to do the work. This whole idea, possibility of America, there's the possibility of progress really is because of us. And we have the ability to do something and should take that result. So take your puzzle piece and move it and put it in the place. And it'll take 20 years for some and others, it'll be a lifetime. But the fact that that puzzle piece is moving is really, really, really important. And we have to all know that each of us has the ability to do something and each of us has the responsibility to do something.
All right. Sam, I guess you've got the choice of either corners, edges, or inside pieces. Do you have a preference?
I don't know which piece it is, but I'll speak briefly. I think, you know, my one thing that I keep on coming back to is maintain curiosity. I think if you're curious about people, if you're curious about the world, then you know, it's hard. It's that much harder to be afraid. It's that much harder to act and speak scornfully, to dismiss other people. And so, I think it's on all of us to go out into the world and with curiosity, still holding the beliefs that we hold.
All right, thank you, Steve.
I thank you, by the way, for this opportunity. I just think the key is to be present to people unlike us, to be quiet and just listen, feel the pain, feel the story, feel the love. And, Thomas Donahue, the Catholic theologian, said, love is fidelity to the demand of a relationship. Well, if you're not in a relationship, it's hard to find what it means to be loving and allied. So I think the creator's got spiderweb powers. And when two souls meet, she lets that spiderweb, and you can't pull away, right? And so just let the spider web work, right? Just get to know people that are different. And I think we can find our way to helping improve life for all of us. Thank you.
All right, amen to that. On behalf of the Interfaith Leadership Council, I want to thank all of you for being part of this really rich and vibrant discussion. Shirley Stancato, Sam Englander, Steve Spreitzer. From me, Saeed Khan, thank you so much for joining our conversation. And please keep the conversation going in your own communities. Again, the kind of curiosity, the kind of empathy, and the metrics of having conversations in real time with real people are parts of the solution to help us with our diversity and inclusion. Thanks so much.